A couple of the major symptoms of the political and social breakdown that is increasingly afflicting our world are tribalism and polarization, and they are, of course, closely related to one another. More and more of us forge our identity by aligning ourselves with the social norms, beliefs, and attitudes of particular groups. And those groups increasingly define themselves by their vehement opposition to the norms, beliefs, and attitudes of other groups. This is especially easy to illustrate from the USA at present, partly because it's always easier to see things more clearly in cultures other than your own. What did Jesus say about logs and specks and arrow? And partly because the USA always seems to do everything on a bigger scale than anyone else. According to various polls, 77% of American voters believe that people who strongly support the other political side are a clear and present danger to the nation. And 45% of Americans think members of the opposing party are downright evil. 77% have few or no friends from the other side. And 48% of Republicans place their feelings about Democrats at zero on a 100% scale, and 39% of Democrats did the same about Republicans. And in case you think it has always been thus, those last couple of stats have risen 76-fold and 43-fold in just 5 years. On top of this, 86% of Americans say that they feel exhausted by the division in their country and say that they think political polarization is a threat to America. Voters identify political polarization and division as a major threat to democracy, and 70% say that America has become so polarized that it can no longer solve the major issues facing the country, and they think those differences will only continue to grow. And if you line those stats up, it tells you that many of those who think polarization is a major problem are themselves examples of it. Now, here in Australia, the picture is a little different, not necessarily any better, but different. For the most part, we Australians just vote for political parties. We don't identify ourselves as belonging to them. Mostly, we don't like them, any of them, very much. So the things we demonize about each other are less likely to be part of party political. But if you were to ask issue by issue, I think you'd find that our levels of polarization are trending in the same direction as the USA. Progressive versus conservative, pro-vax versus anti-vax, Christian versus atheist, climate change activism versus climate change denial, open borders versus anti-immigration, vegan versus double beef and bacon cheeseburger, Australia Day versus change the date, evolution versus six-day creation, trans-affirming versus anti-trans. And of course, so big in the news of this past week, pro-Palestinian versus pro-Israeli. Now, I don't have a set of statistics for here, but from my observations, it seems that Australians too are becoming more and more reluctant to listen to one another and respect one another across these divides. If you hold certain views, you are deemed not worth listening to. And because where you fall on one of those issues is often a pretty reliable indicator of where you will fall on many of the others, we seem to be becoming more and more siloed into opposing tribes with clear-cut boundaries and non-negotiable orthodoxies. Of course, tribalism is nothing new. The fact that the word itself evokes images of prehistoric times should be enough to make it clear that it's been around for a while. It's probably true that our tendencies to tribalism have risen and fallen many times down through the centuries. And it is most certainly true that we are most prone to reverting to tribal thinking when we feel that everything we hold dear, or even our very existence, is under threat. We want to identify someone to blame. So, with the increasing existential threats of all-out war and of global climate catastrophe, it's probably no surprise that we would again be seeing an upswing of polarization. But what is really scary this time is that the polarization itself is supercharging the existential threats. And even if you think that's overstated, you'll probably be willing to agree that polarization is undermining our capacity to cooperate with one another in addressing these threats. Another reason that we know that tribalism and polarization are not new is by the significant role that they play in so many of the stories in the Bible. We don't always notice, though, because when the dividing issues are not our issues, references to them can seem like innocuous details. In the gospel reading we heard a little while ago, there is a little comment about one of the characters that said, "And he was a Samaritan." Now, unless we have a reasonable grasp of first century Middle Eastern society, we might not know whether that's an innocuous comment like, "And he was a South Australian," or a highly charged comment like, "And he was a neo-Nazi." In fact, a geographically and socially accurate translation of that line could be, "And he was a West Bank Palestinian." And the tribal impact of that in today's Israel would be much the same as it was in Jesus' day. In the story we heard, though, suspicion of this guy goes further. This guy was a West Bank Palestinian leper. There are layers and layers of marginalization in this story. Luke's account of it begins with a reference to the geographical margins. The story takes place in the border region between the lands of two polarized tribal groups. And in this marginal place, 10 lepers approach Jesus and call out from a safe distance, asking for his mercy. Now, at this stage of the story, we are not told anything about their ethnic identities, just that they are lepers, very marginalized people in a marginalized place. In the early stages of the COVID pandemic, a number of us experienced a little taste of what it is like when a society is terrified of an illness and of anyone who has it. Any of us who tested positive had to notify everyone around us that we were unclean so that they could avoid us, and we had to take responsibility for isolating ourselves from the healthy people. If you can remember that feeling, take that and multiply it up for being in a society with no scientific understanding of infection or transmission, for being an illness that produced frightening physical deformities, and for there being no likelihood that it would pass in 7 to 14 days, and then you might be beginning to understand what these 10 lepers were living with. The experience, for those of you who are old enough, of the early parts of the AIDS epidemic were perhaps somewhat similar, except that the fear of transmission just casually was not the same, but the layers of stigma and marginalization were even greater. In the little Palestinian town of Berkin, which claims to be the site where this miracle took place, pretty much every story in the Gospels has a site somewhere in Israel or Palestine that claims to be the location of the story, sometimes several places. But this one associated with the town of Berkin. And there's an archaeological ruin of an old Roman cistern. It's an underground water reservoir. And according to local legend, it was already disused in the time of Jesus, and it was the place where the local lepers had to live, with food and drink being lowered into them through the opening where the rainwater ran in. Now, whether that's true or not, it tells you a lot about how isolated and shunned lepers were in that society. So these 10 lepers, who have not been differentiated from one another in the story yet, call out to Jesus for help, and he tells them to go and show themselves to the priests, which was what you had to do if you were no longer leprous and you wanted to be allowed to integrate back into your family and community. Today, you would get a doctor's certificate, then you got a priest's certificate. Now, there's an interesting sermon that could be preached about how much trust in Jesus it took for these 10 to head off towards the priest before their symptoms cleared, because the story tells us that it only happened on the way. And there's another interesting sermon which I've seen under the title of When Is It Right to Disobey Jesus? Because it's actually the nine who didn't return who did what Jesus told them to do. I'm not chasing either of those tantalizing rabbits today, nor am I going with the most common sermon topic picked up from the story, which is the importance of gratitude. One of the ten, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God in a loud voice. He prostrated himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him, and he was a West Bank Palestinian. And Jesus asked, "Is this outsider the only one who comes back to give praise to God?" So it's only at this point of the story that we are told that this one of the ten had a different ethnic or tribal identity to the others. So while all ten were incredibly marginalized by their illness, this one was further marginalized. And it's one of the unfortunate truths about human nature that even the most disadvantaged and marginalized groups will usually have someone among them that even they look down on. Why? Because nobody wants to be the absolute dregs of society. So as long as we have someone that's lower than us, we can feel that we still have some worth. Perhaps the only real difference between scapegoating and hyper-polarized tribalism is whether you are pointing the finger at a tiny minority or at a whole half of society. Either way, we are dehumanizing people in a way that is probably one of the fundamental dynamics of original sin. Luke could have told this story without mentioning that the man was a Samaritan. And Jesus didn't need to draw attention to it either. And then this sermon probably would be just about the importance of gratitude. But when an otherwise unnecessary detail is highlighted, it usually becomes the main point. I'm actually a little embarrassed that I never noticed that about this story before. And it's strange because I've noticed it and preached on it numerous times in relation to the parable of the Good Samaritan. I pointed out that if Jesus was to use that parable in different contexts, like ours perhaps, he would have tweaked it to make it the good homophobe or the good transsexual or the good manosphere influencer or the good whoever it was that was the most despised group among the particular audience of the occasion. The connection to the parable of the Good Samaritan is probably a deliberate move by Luke, the gospel writer. You see, if you were to ask the Jews of that day why they despised the Samaritans so much, their answer would have been that it was because their worship was all wrong. They didn't worship God in the prescribed ways. But what the Samaritan leper does in this story is do an exemplary job of offering appropriate praise and thanksgiving to God. Is this outsider the only one who can come back and give praise to God appropriately? Asks Jesus. And where that connects to the Good Samaritan is that the context in which Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan was when he had been asked what was the greatest commandment, and he said that the two greatest commandments, in fact, the two that contain all the rest, are to love God and to love your neighbor. So here we have in these two stories, Jesus holding up a couple of Samaritans as the role models in how to love God and how to love your neighbor. Now, it seems to me that by deliberately choosing to hold up as role models members of the rival tribe that his audience most despised, Jesus is directly addressing their tribalism. And it's probably not too much of a stretch to say that he wants them to hear that their polarization, their intertribal hostility, is the biggest obstacle to their capacity to fulfill the most important commandments, to love God and to love your neighbor. Now, I don't know who it is for you that is the group you most think of as completely beyond the pale, as depraved and a danger to everything that is good and decent. Maybe it's those neo-Nazis who've been in the news a lot lately. Maybe it's the far-right faction of the Israeli parliament. Maybe it's the gambling industry strategists who send inducements to known problem gamblers. Maybe it's those who want trans kids sent to psych hospitals. Maybe it's just Collingwood supporters. Whoever it is, Jesus is going to challenge you and me to recognize one of them as providing an outstanding example of love of neighbor, and another of them as an outstanding example of not taking God's mercy for granted, but offering genuine, heartfelt praise and thanksgiving. And in that, then, the ultimate challenge that Jesus is laying before us is to overcome our tribalism, our polarization, our bitter rivalries, and to recognize and honor in this most uncomfortable other the image of God. We can be on the right side of history about any number of important social causes, but if we are refusing to see and honor the image of God in our opponents, we will be on the wrong side of what God is seeking to do in the world. No matter how much energy we put into fighting for the right causes, if we demonize our opponents and refuse to listen to them with respect or even just gentle curiosity, then all our activism will achieve is a backlash from our opponents that counteracts our work and ensures that nothing really shifts. As long as we are allowing the orthodoxies of our tribe, however good and right they may be, to blind us to any good in the members of rival tribes, we will be increasingly part of the problem, not part of the solution. Jesus was really hardline and resolute about this stuff, and I'm guessing that he would be at least as hardline about it today. Because today, our tribalism and polarization is armed with the technology and weapons to destroy all life on Earth. And avoiding that depends on enough of us taking our lead from Jesus and calling out the best in one another and learning how to respect one another and cooperate together. You and I can't make that happen. We can't save the world. But what we can do is follow Jesus and, like him, become role models of loving our enemies and seeing all people, no matter how unlike us they may be, as one global family, equally loved by God and capable of great love and beauty. And in that lie the seeds of the salvation of the world.